I hear that the sign of the Weeping Virgin is perhaps the first in a series you're writing.
Yes, I have just started writing the second book in the series. Actually, it's going to take place a few years before The Sign of the Weeping Virgin does, for various reasons.
Is that because after you finished The Sign of the Weeping Virgin, there was just so much to say about what happened before?
Well, what happens in The Sign of the Weeping Virgin is that my main character, Guido Antonio Vespucci, in real life, he is a real-life Florentine powerful lawyer and Medici supporter. When the book ends in 1480, he actually went to Rome. And I thought, I don't want to go to Rome. I want to stay in Florence with my people that I like so much. And also his sidekick, we'll say, is his nephew, Amerigo Vespucci. And Amerigo did not go with Guido Antonio to Rome. And I like to stick with the facts as much as I can. And by going back in time, I could have them work on another mystery together and keep some of the characters that I'd grown fond of. You know, if I had started in 1480 in Rome, it would have been an entire different cast of characters and therefore not so much of a series, honestly. So I just decided to go back into 1473 and see what I could do there.
Recount for me how you fell in love with these people.
I remember, you know, as clearly as if it were yesterday, I was sitting on the patio in the sunshine reading an old issue of National Geographic magazine. It was an article on the Pazzi conspiracy, which at the elevation of the host on April 26, 1478, assassins crept forth in Florence Cathedral under Brunelleschi's dome with the intention of murdering Giuliano de' Medici and his brother Lorenzo de' Medici. Florence was a democratic government, but of course the Medici family, they were the behind-the-scenes rulers, let's say. So anyway, the assassins wanted to get rid of these two young brothers. They managed to kill Giuliano, but Lorenzo escaped. He threw his cape over his arm, drew his sword, jumped over the altar, ran to the sacristy, and I thought, well, that is really interesting, and I'd love to read the novel that's been written about that. And what I found out was that there wasn't one, and I thought, well, I'm a writer, so I'll do it. And so after mountains of research, you know, here it is, finally.
I thought it was so lovely that you credited the Nashville Public Library with providing you a room of your own.
Yes, they have about four or five rooms that are available to writers, and you can apply for one. And, you know, if you're fortunate, and I've been very fortunate, they will grant you one. And I've had the use of one several times now. And it's really nice to be able to go into that room and close that door. There's nothing else you can do in there, you know, with your laptop and your notebooks and just your thoughts and your imagination. You're entirely alone by yourself. So,
without giving away anything, the action of The Sign of the Weeping Virgin.
What happened in actual history was that the Florentines were appalled to learn that the main person behind the plot to kill the two Medici brothers was none other than the Pope in Rome. And so little Florence wound up going to war with Rome and also with the King of Naples. My main character, and this is true, went to France as the ambassador of Florence, and he took with him Amerigo Vespucci, which was something I found really interesting. I had no idea at that time that Amerigo Vespucci had ever been to France at the court of Louis XI, you know. So anyway, that is the backdrop of the story. The story begins when they come back to Florence and they think, you know, oh, everything's great, the war is over, we can start all over again. Guido Antonio hasn't seen his wife or son in 2 years. The little boy doesn't know him, of course, because they've been apart for these 2 years. Well, naturally, everything works just the opposite the way that he thinks it will. And one of the first things he finds out is that there is a painting of the Virgin Mary that has started weeping in a church in Florence, not just any church, but the Vespucci family church. And people are interpreting those tears as a sign of God's disapproval with Florence for going to war with the church. So that's the big tapestry. So one of the mysteries that Guido Antonio must solve is what is making that painting weep. And then also a young woman has gone missing on a short trip she was taking, and people are saying that she has been kidnapped by the Turks and been sold into slavery, and people are saying that that as well is a sign that God is going to rain punishment down on them all. So that's the fourth story, with really the Potsie conspiracy in the background. It's not a political book by any means, you know.
It sounds rich.
Well, thank you.
Would you favor us with a bit of it?
Yes, I'll begin. I'll just read the first page, which is a very short prologue. And I like to do that because it does set up the burden of guilt that Guido Antonio carries with himself throughout the book. He feels guilty for not preventing Giuliano de' Medici's death, and that thread carries throughout the book. So I'll just start. Guido Antonio entered Florence Cathedral late that Easter Sunday morning, blinking as the front door closed and the sun lost itself to darkness. Inside the sanctuary, he cut through the nave past whooshing torches, jostling men from his path, his aggravation mounting. Already the choir's singular, sweet voice had fallen to a hush, and people were bowing their heads, anticipating the elevation of the host. Determined, he pushed through the crowd to Lorenzo de' Medici's dark, muscular figure near the south side of the altar, where they had agreed to meet this morning, but drew back when he glimpsed Lorenzo's brother, Giuliano, strangely isolated with Francesco de' Pazzi and Bernardo Bandini on the far opposite side of the church. Those three were not friends. Wiry, way-haired Francesco seemed nervous, snaking his arm around Giuliano's shoulders, casting furtive glances here and there. Guido Antonio's eyes flicked toward Lorenzo and then back again. He did not see Bandini's axe till the blade flashed in the candlelight and sliced down on Giuliano's head. After that, time slowed down as if luxuriously uncoiling itself in a long, dark strand. Giuliano fell to his knees, his hood pouring blood. Francesco jumped on him in wild excitement, ripping his knife into the soft flesh of Giuliano's bare neck. Near them, a boy cried out, "The dome's coming down." Men, women, and children flailed and fell over one another in a wave of fear and panic. "No," Guido Antonio cried, "Giuliano." He clawed forward but repeatedly lost ground, as if ghost hands had hold of his crimson cloak, pulling him back by the hem. "Giuliano." His good young friend stabbed over and over again, as if he were a plaything made of scrap cloth rather than hardened muscle and bone, murdered while Guido Antonio watched from a distance. How could he have been so helpless? And so it's that burden of guilt, as I say, that, you know, follows him through the book. One of the things that he says or in his thoughts is that he's never going to go in Florence Cathedral again. And as I told a group the other night at a presentation I did, of course, we as good readers know that that's exactly what he will do at the end of the book to provide the resolution that we need to bring the story to a close. And actually, the primary reason I think that I'm going to go back in time for the next book is, of course, in this book, Giuliano has been killed. You know, he appears in memories and visions and things like that, but he's basically, you know, he's dead. Whereas if I go back in time, he gets to be a real person, and I want to do that for him. And for me, I like him.
Tell me about historical fiction versus history and the reader experience.
Well, by doing it as fiction, you know, I was very scrupulous. I did a lot of research. And honestly, one of the reasons I chose to make the main character Guido Antonio Vespucci rather than Lorenzo de' Medici, which is the way I had begun, was because there's, you know, Lorenzo de' Medici is such a giant figure in the Italian Renaissance. And by going to someone who was an associate and friend and comrade of his, I could narrow the story down and make it more manageable. Quite a bit is known about Guido Antonio because he was, as I say, a powerful lawyer, but not as much is known as, you know, about him as there is about Giuliano and Lorenzo de' Medici, for goodness sake. So I was able to harness the research. But to answer your question, that gives me more leeway to go into, to create a life for Guido Antonio. You know, for example, we know that he was married to a young woman named Maria Del Vigna. That's all we know. And so when I think about him returning to Florence after being in Florence away from her for 2 years, then I have the liberty of imagining what would that actually be like. And I don't feel as constrained as I would have been if I were imagining that, say, for Lorenzo de' Medici or someone like that. Does that make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
And I could make connections for Guido Antonio more in his relationships with other people. And I really like doing that. I think one of the reasons maybe no one had written a book, you know, maybe quite like this before is Guido Antonio's right around the corner neighbor is Sandro Botticelli. He knew Leonardo da Vinci, and I could not ignore that. To write a story about him at this time, you can't just pretend those people aren't there. In fact, there's a scene when Guido Antonio first sees the painting called Primavera that Botticelli has painted while Guido Antonio was out of town. And in it, there is a representation of Giuliano de' Medici. And, of course, it hurts his heart. And so I got to describe his reaction when he first sees that beautiful painting by Botticelli of his good, you know, gone friend.
Tell me something. You've obviously traveled to Florence quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Have you traveled since writing this book? And I wonder what it felt like when you were done with the book and there in town, if you did.
Yes, I was there in May, and through one of those wonderful serendipitous series of events, I have met a young woman who is actually doing her doctorate on the Vespucci family. It's just one of those things, it's a magical moment that happened, and we have connected. And so she introduced me through email to some people in Florence. You know, I was nervous about that, I'll be honest. I was thinking, you know, what will these people think? You know, I've written about their city in all this detail. Are they going to go, well, this is, you know, that building isn't there, that church, you know, whatever. But, you know, instead I was invited to a symposium on Renaissance music, theater, and dance, and the person who was head of that introduced me to everyone, and I just felt so honored. Also, there's an English-speaking bookstore called the B&M, I think, English Bookshop. It's the oldest bookstore in Florence that carries books in English, and they are carrying the book. I felt very encouraged and very welcomed by the Florentines, which is like a dream come true for me.
How very exciting for you that experience was. I look forward to reading the book, and I thank you for speaking with me this afternoon.
Well, thank you so much, and I'm looking forward to being in Murray. It's like coming home. It'll be fun.
When you say it's like coming home, where is home?
My people were pioneers from Virginia who settled in Lyon County and Caldwell County, and so I remember going back there in summers to visit my grandparents. I remember when my mother's high school, Eddyville High School, was flooded to make way for the lakes, and I remember how she cried over that. My great-grandmother was named America Jane Kinsolving. My grandmother was named Lena Bell. My great-grandfather was James Monroe Talley. So it's Talleys, Kinsolvers, Bells. And I've actually come to Katie's before and been to the library to do genealogy research because I just love that. And so much to the point that I finally just had to say, enough, I can't do this and write a book as well.